My name is Clark Scheibe. I am the director or coordinator at Canadian Labrie. And this is probably my 15th year to be at the Rochester Conference. So I'm really thankful to be here. And it's always good to see people and to catch up again. Now, I'm intrigued on why you would come to this talk. And I'll be intrigued why you left this talk. Or, you know, what you left with, I meant. I doubt whether we are sufficiently attentive to the importance of elementary textbooks. Do y'all know where that line comes from? That's C.S. Lewis starts The Abolition of Man with that line. And I think that's true. We haven't paid close attention to what is being taught in schools. What is the philosophy? What is the worldview as the base for education? And so C.S. Lewis in 1944 in The Abolition of Man begins by looking at this prep school book for these grammarians. He calls it the Green Book, and he says that the authors are Gaius and Titius. And the grammarians, in teaching about predicates, speak about these two tourists who walk up to a waterfall, and one of them says it's pretty and the other one says it's sublime. And Gaius and Titius say this about the statement: when the man said, "That is sublime," he appeared to be making a remark about the waterfall. Actually, he was not making a remark about the waterfall, but a remark about his own feelings. What he was saying was really, "I have feelings associated in my mind with the word sublime," or shortly, "I have sublime feelings." They continue, "To make sure that you're clear about the philosophy that they're promoting, this confusion is continually present in language as we use it. We appear to be saying something very important about something, and actually we are only saying something about our own feelings." So this is 1944. So Lewis says this in response, that these people are probably unaware of the impact that they're going to make in these children's lives, and maybe they're not intentional. But the important thing is that they say that you appear to be saying something important about the external world, but really you're talking about something internal, your feelings. Really, they're unaware of their own subjectivism, that the meaning of the world begins within. And so what Lewis is arguing is saying we've lost touch with external reality. We're losing touch with the moral law behind the external world. And so Lewis, throughout the book, is making an argument about how we need to teach students how to raise their emotions to love what is lovely and to hate what is wicked. But in 1984, 40 years on, you have Alan Bloom writing in his famous book, The Closing of the American Mind. He says, "There is one thing a professor can be absolutely certain of. Almost every student entering the university believes, or says he believes, that truth is relative." So what has happened in 1944 in elementary prep school has now thoroughly invaded the universities in 1984. Now, Bloom understands why there needs to be this openness, because there's been so many wars about certainty. Whenever someone has been certain, it's created wars and conquest. No one has a right to have one claim over another. But the problem, Bloom says, is that they can point out the problems of others, but they themselves cannot defend their own position. They have no base. And so, as one president of Harvard said, it has extinguished the motivation for education. Why learn anything? What then becomes the reason for education if no one else can tell you what to believe or how to think or how to construct your own ideas? Reality or morality is reduced to what's within me, and the external world becomes further and further distant. Well, then move into 40 years, that's in air quotes, 2024. It's not 2024 yet. I'm still getting used to 2023. But what you have here is a flyer at Georgetown University. And it says, how do microaggressions make you feel? A microaggression is defined as a statement, action, or incident regarded as an instance of indirect, subtle, or unintentional discrimination against members of a marginalized group, such as racial or ethnic minority. Now, there's no denying that these things happen all the time. Perhaps a white woman clutches her purse a little bit more tightly when a black man is passing her on the sidewalk, maybe not in the same way as she would a white man. Or perhaps a white man telling a black woman that she sounds surprisingly articulate. These are true microaggressions. So they're not denying. But Jonathan Haidt, in his book, The Calling of the American Mind, wants to draw attention to the unintentional discrimination. It's not what people intend, but what is the impact. So you can see here it says, #KnowYourImpact. How do the microaggressions make you feel? Because there are times when it might be ambiguous. At a branch of LaBrie, there's a painting of a black woman and a white woman working in a field. It's a French painting. And the students got into an uproar because they said that the painting was triggering. And so the workers gathered around and asked, who's been triggered by this painting? And no one spoke. And someone said, well, someone could potentially be triggered by this painting, having this black woman, you know, just reminding them of slavery and all these things. Well, the director of that branch did a deeper dive and found that that painting was done by a French artist who was actually trying to elevate the status of this French black woman as they worked in the field together on a level field. It showed co-dominion. And then, so in fact, it was intending something the opposite. But you can see where intention is not the true meaning. The true meaning is the impact or the potential impact. It's about the potential emotional harm that can be had. And so Lewis in 1944 spoke about feeling being severed from fact. Bloom says now universities are dominated by relativism. And now we even have the potential harm is violence. It's the severing of the external world and putting emphasis on the internal world or internal perception. And so what Lewis said is that we've given insufficient attention to what is being taught in textbooks or what's being taught at schools. In fact, when I talk to people, when they ask us why we homeschool, and I mentioned earlier that we do homeschool, but I'm also in favor of public schools and private schools. In Canada, it's a very different type of situation. You can talk to me or ask me in the discussion time if you want. But what I've been surprised at is how ignorant parents are of what is actually being taught to their children in the schools. And it became a wake-up call for some parents when COVID happened and the children had to go home and parents started beginning to see what their children were learning or what they weren't learning. And so we do need to listen to Lewis and say we need to pay closer attention to what philosophy of education is being promoted in what is being taught and how it's being taught. So what I want to be arguing for in this talk is what has been taught and an alternative. And so, So I want to say that what has been taught has caused students to or learners to become fearful, fragmented, and fragile. But in light of this predominant worldview that has caused this, I want to argue for a worldview that promotes delight, coherence, and dignity. So this is what the biblical worldview gives, delight, coherence, and dignity. It's actually a love for creation, a love for God, and a love for what it means to be human as a base for re-understanding education or reforming education. So the first I want to look at is delight. Particularly, we need to delight in the world around us, in creation. However, that's not what learners are receiving. They're becoming more and more detached by how schools are taught, that the world is, that nature is mechanical, impersonal, and non-purposeful. All that is left is their own egos or their own consciousness to try to carve out meaning. So I want to show you what Charles Taylor, a Canadian philosopher well known for a book called The Secular Age, he talks about the inward turn. So when I was mentioning Lewis pointing to these two grammarians separating fact from feeling, it's actually the story started a lot earlier to get to the point where we are now in the flow of ideas. Well, Taylor really wants to start where theism became deism, and he thinks that the inward turn happened at the moment where, like, in a secular age, he says, 500 years ago, and for the majority of the history of the world, people believed in the gods. But in the past 500 years, it's too incredible to believe in a god. The burden of proof in the pre-modern world was to prove that no god exists when it's so obvious. And now you have to prove that God exists because it seems so impossible. So he wants, how did this come to be? And he talks about how this inward turn happened, how we went from looking to the external world into moving it into the internal world. And what this does has created this separation. I want to go through it quickly because I'll go through a form of these kind of histories a couple of times. So at the beginning, there was this idea of theism, these natural laws that God created everything, or the gods, and either you were superstitious or the Judeo-Christian worldview was that the world could be investigated. But you always wanted to understand revelation, what was being told from the gods to us. But as the Christian church influenced society, the sciences grew, well, they started having this in-house debate, this very highfalutin debate on, okay, God created the world. Did he create it perfectly or did he not? And did when he created these natural laws, are these laws something that he has to, when you see a flower, is it something that grows according to natural law, or is God always kind of attending each spot? And so they had to ask, would God have created something deficient? Like, let's say if I sold you a watch, and I said, I have a watch for you. It's really amazing watch. It's perfect. And you take it, and you're like, thank you. This looks very nice. And I'm constantly coming around, and I'm always tinkering with it. What are you doing? I just love this watch. I'm just going to tinker with it. It's like, no. This is not a very good watch. And so the idea was like, well, if God created a perfect world, then he would have created natural laws that function on their own. And so we don't need revelation. We can just look to the natural laws to understand God's order. Well, Taylor says this was the movement toward deism. Deism is this idea of God is this kind of impersonal character who's created all things but has no interaction with the world as it is now. But in time, that base, they had to ask, well, what was the base to know that this knowledge is true? If we're not basing it on external revelation, well, the idea was rationalism. God has given us God-given reason to understand the world around us, and that will help us to understand. But what happened is that God moved to nature, and now nature has moved to the human mind. And that, as the human mind, as Descartes and the Cartesian revolution of trying to figure out everything through rationality, it created a coldness in nature that people felt very uncomfortable with, particularly as human nature itself started being explained away as mechanical. And so people reacted, and it's called Romanticism, where they were looking for this inner genius in order to manifest themselves upon nature. They wanted to resonate with nature, and so this wasn't a full-blown expressivism, but it was this idea of, like, the artist. You think of Wordsworth and Shelley and Lord Byron. These types of romantic poets were trying to express themselves in a world that seemed quite mechanical. But that eventually moved to what Taylor. They have some similarities. But what Taylor says has moved to a full-blown individualistic expressivism, which means that what is meaning is how I express myself. It's not just what I do, but even how I feel and how I'm able to express myself. And so that has moved toward expressive. And so what we have is this path from God to nature to mind to feeling. And it just goes further and further in. And Taylor's saying as we get further and further into ourselves, the more detached we are to the external world. And so he says that there's two kinds of selves. There's the pre-modern self is the porous self. The modern self is the buffered self. And so the porous self is the one that is open to the gods. It can be open to grace. It can be open to possession. And it was the flow of nature and the person flowed back and forth. But the modern self is detached and considers that even for the Christian, it's hard to believe that the world is personal. My son loves learning about black holes and all these types of things. And he said, just, you know, we seem so insignificant. And I said, you made a jump there. We aren't insignificant. God has made an amazing world, but we're still significant because God holds it as personal. But as we learn, as science has expanded, we can sometimes be taught to feel less and less about our own dignity, our own self. And so what has happened is that people have begun to feel in schools without God that they are ghosts in the machine. I don't know if you can see that very well. That's a ghost with a lot of 1011s around that man, it looks like. And so people feel that they are ghosts in a machine. And despite all the distractions we have of the newest discoveries of the forest galaxies or the newest discoveries of the human genome, in the end, it's all impersonal. Humans are feeling impersonal. You can have the applause for the newest medicines, the newest technology, but you have to ask, to what end? And so we constantly want to distract ourselves, not knowing what is the ultimate meaning of it all. And so education is to promote the continuation and the accumulation of human knowledge. But it has produced the most reflective students toward despair. Nature is no longer a wonder, it's an enemy. And nature is without pity, without concern, without feeling. And so it's against this meaninglessness, against this existential crisis of meaning and purpose, that we must understand the modern transgender movement. It's really the other side of the same coin. That was my cool little PowerPoint presentation. I forgot, just like, you know, coin flipping. It's the different side of the same coin. In elementary schools in British Columbia, Canada, students are taught about the gender unicorn. Maybe you're familiar with this. I don't know if it's used here. What I want us to see is that the orientations of a person, so this is taught, it's called SOGI 123, and sexual orientation, gender identity, or gender inclusion. And this is taught at the elementary level in Canada. And so what it's being, and what you have is a purple unicorn that looks slightly hippo-ish and has these separate gender identity, gender expression, physical attraction, emotional attraction, and sex assigned at birth. In fact, this used to be the gender-bred person, but they thought the person looked too masculine. They needed something more amorphous. They also had biological sex. They changed it to sex assigned at birth. So this is the advancement and what is being currently taught. But what I want us to see is the orientations of the person, their emotions, their feelings, their attractions, their identity is set upon a blank canvas of the world. Sex assigned at birth. Their identity is at war with biology or constructionism. So anatomy should not or does not create gender or sexual identity. Therefore, meaning has to be discovered within. But I want us to have compassion because it's a crisis of meaning that people are looking for. When they look that there is nothing, they're told that everything is within, and so it becomes their expression in which they have to carve out their identity. And so within secular education, we have these two opposing forces at work, that nature is mechanical, impersonal, non-purposeful, being taught in the hard sciences and the economics and politics and medicine and more. And on the other hand, the students are encouraged, not exclusively, but predominantly in the area of sexuality and gender, to express their own wills and to carve out a meaningful existence against the chaos. But what they have in common is that it's a nature that is inherently meaningless. It's either to be accepted in its cold complexity, or it is to be fought against as ghosts in a machine. And so no wonder students feel in despair. We need to have compassion. We need to have compassion when we talk about this issue. Now, how does the Bible speak about this? How might we encourage delight instead of fear? Well, the value and purpose of nature comes on its very first page. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Multiple times, God delights in his creation, calls it good and very good. So biblically speaking, creation is a gift, not a given. Creation is not inevitable or necessary, but a free act of God's grace and love. And so this should give us joy and wonder at the joy of the complexities and the size of the universe. What's also important to know here is that creation, while independent of its creator, is constantly dependent on God. God sustains the world by his breath and sustains it by his powerful word. This is not a sign of his deficiency. You remember that the image of the watch, me following around? Well, it would be seen as a sign of deficiency if God is constantly sustaining and intervening and interacting. But it's not seen as a sign of deficiency. It's his constant care and relationship to a world that is dependent on his glory and his being. And so that's why this continual relationship is why Paul can say it's evidence for God's eternal power. Or the psalmist says creation pours forth speech. Or the Bible speaks about the whole world is full of his glory. It's because it is constantly being upheld by the relationship God has to his creation. He delights and upholds it and loves it. And so consider the impact this has for education. The whole tradition behind the wisdom books is trying to discover what God has done in the world. You have the law, and that is God's commands and trying to work out ethical issues. But wisdom is really trying to discern, observe, and understand the relationship of God's creation. And in Solomon's wisdom, he's considered the wisest man of all. In 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 30 through 34, it speaks of his wisdom in what way? It's not just that he wrote thousands of proverbs, but he spoke about plant life from the cedar of Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of walls. He also spoke about animals and birds, reptiles and fish. From all nations, people came to listen to Solomon's wisdom. It's interesting. He had a deep love and delight in the world, in creation. So it wasn't his love for God or having a religious education removed him from the world. Actually, it enabled him to embrace it, to engage it. As my children have up on the wall, it is the glory of God to conceal a matter, but the glory of the kings is to search out a matter. God has created the world with so much that we don't know yet, and it's his joy to give that to us, to conceal it, and it's our joy to discover it. It's like a surprise. My brother, My brother, at Christmas time for his family, they always have a secret envelope package, and they have to always figure it out and find where it is through all these riddles. And then there's like a big prize at the end. They're going on a trip or a concert as a family. But it's a joy to look and try to discover the riddle. And God has created this riddle of existence, not to create despair, but delight, that there's constant wonder. And in fact, that's why I think heaven, we won't know everything. It will be a continual investigation of what God has made through his infinite wisdom. And there's a student that passed through. She had been quite burnt out, but at LaBrie, she had this renewed vigor for life. And so what she has done is she's created a program called Thrive. And it welcomes kids after school to go into nature and to learn about the world around them. And even though it has a Christian base, and she's explicit about it, there's people in a very anti-Christian country letting their kids go because they're seeing that this is good for their kids to be outside, because otherwise they're at home behind the computers, or, you know, they have an inordinate amount of homework. They're just seen as brains on sticks, but she wants to see them as whole persons engaging a whole world. This is a type of education that is offering delight, not fear. I had a sign of virtual goggles, or, you know, is the new way of education. And that's my nightmare, I think. It's my son's dream. So not only students are given a cold, pitiless universe that they have to work against, but that's also been given to them as fragmented. There's a failure to understand how the universe, how all things hold together. And so universities are supposed to be places where students go in order to have their minds broadened, to see a wider view, but also to see how things go together. And so that's why you have the university used to have a series of disciplines where you became a more well-rounded citizen. But it has not become that anymore. There's Alain de Botton. He was born in Switzerland, but he's a British pop philosopher. He's an atheist, Atheist 2.0. You may have heard of him. But he says in his book, Religion for Atheists, whatever rhetoric may be rehearsed in its prospectuses, the modern university appears to have precious little interest in teaching its students any emotional or ethical life skills, much less how to love their neighbors and leave the world happier than they found it. Why is this? Well, Alain de Botton says, well, it's not because we haven't have adequate resources. We have all the knowledge that we need. The Enlightenment is not a failure. Rather, we just haven't properly utilized the great secular works in a way that provides meaning. How might we promote Cicero, Michel de Montaigne, and all these people, and Carl Sagan? How can we promote meaning in these works? Well, his idea is to use religious techniques. Since he doesn't believe that God exists, he thinks that Christians have been very powerful and religious people have been very powerful at creating meaning systems, not because they're true, but because they've had really good techniques. They've sung songs. They've gathered together. And so he goes, maybe we need to have a church calendar for the school. Maybe we need to give close exegetical readings of Moby Dick. Maybe we need to read Anna Karenina on the effects of outside of affairs. We need to repeat these truths just each Sunday, and we even need to learn how to preach like pastors. Shakespeare said, amen. He literally says these things. But what he fails to recognize is that meaning does not come from technique. It's simply another mechanical tool in a meaningless world. It's a return to the Tower of Babel and ends in confusion. And so the Greco-Roman, I'm going to give you another quick little breeze through history, but the Greco-Roman culture had a canon. And the canon of works, cultural works, were for freeborn boys. But as science expanded, as knowledge expanded, through the Enlightenment, we started cataloging the information into encyclopedias. And at first, these encyclopedias would have plant kingdom, animal kingdom, and they even had a hierarchy, the chain of being. But that changed with Diderot, and he alphabetized this encyclopedia because the information started getting more and more expansive. But as encyclopedias grew more and more, it became specialized encyclopedias. And it grew more and more. And then and with the internet, we now have Wikipedia. Wikipedia is now a place through an algorithm, a form, to create all human knowledge into one area. It can be human opinion, it can be experts, it can be lay people, whatever. But it's just this database that provides all the human knowledge. You can know Kantian ethics to Albanian punk groups. You can know anything and everything that you don't want to know on Wikipedia and not know it very well. It is helpful in some ways, I'm not going to deny it. But it's a good to just give you a taste of what it might mean. But what happens is that no matter how much information we accumulate, it doesn't give us coherence. It doesn't tell us the purpose or the meaning of the knowledge. Even the great books tradition, which Alan Bloom, I mentioned earlier, The Closing of the American Mind, he and Harold Bloom also, the promoting great books. We've had a couple students come from great books, and they're amazing at quoting Augustine and Cicero, but they don't quite know what it means. And one of my colleagues, he was the director of English Debris, Andrew Fellows, he left and he went to Cambridge, and he's like, Clark, I've met the smartest people in the world. I am really dumb. And I said, no, Andrew, you're a smart guy. He's like, no, I'm serious. I am not smart. These people are smart. And I said, well, what do you have to offer them? He said, coherence, integration. He says they have all this specialized knowledge, but they don't know how it all fits together. And so Neil Postman said, modern secular education is failing, not because it doesn't teach who Ginger Rogers, Norman Mailer, and 1,000 other people are, but because it has no moral, social, or intellectual center. But this is where the Bible succeeds most clearly, that the Bible gives coherence. Irenaeus, he was in the 2nd century, and he noticed that the Bible, no matter how, the Bible was considered very badly written in the Greco-Roman tradition, because it didn't have the high flourish of the Greek rhetoric, the Roman oratory. However, what Irenaeus saw in it is that it was distinct because it gave a story, the overarching story. So he's the first one to really speak of the Bible as story. It was understood as history, but he saw it in light of the myths and the epics, and actually the Bible tells a story. But it's not just a story, it's a story of all people in all places and all times. It gives comprehension and it holds all reality together by what it expresses. It expresses nature not just as a gift, but as one with a purpose, a goal. Now, Schaeffer said that this is possible because God is infinite and God is personal. God in his infinity is able to see all and be over all, and he can see the end of time. But he's also personal, so he's able to communicate. And so God, in his almighty power, in his kindness, reveals his purposes for all people in all times and all places. And so it doesn't mean that the Bible is exhaustive. It doesn't tell us everything we would like to know about cloning or AI. But it gives us a base upon which to approach what is good and lawful knowledge and how we might navigate these ethical dilemmas. We're not just trying to scrape by without it. It's as if you could be the smartest person in the world and you're trying to walk across this room, you're going to hit a lot of chairs. But if you could have a simple child turn on the light, it reveals everything in its place. The Bible, even in its simplicity, reveals where everything fits. And we're able to navigate our lives and society because the Bible shines a light on all this. And so how does this shape the way we educate? Well, Charlotte Mason speaks of the science of relations. Now, in my kids' education, each year, every week, they get a diagram like this. The circle in the middle is God, and on the outside is American literature, Latin, algebra. I can't read the others, but important topics. Can y'all read it?
No.
Okay. But other topics, just imagine them. And so it's not that while we don't know everything, and probably never will, we don't despair because we know that they all hold together because God holds them all together and gives us an understanding. So we're not in despair trying to seek out more knowledge in order to have coherence, but that we seek knowledge because we already have coherence. Do you see what I mean by that? What's also important for Charlotte Mason is that the science of relations is not just like a beautiful mind and seeing how it all fits together, but what does it mean for us as a person, how we engage the world? We're a part of this relationship. So we're not just looking externally, but we're personally involved. And so Jack Beckman, in the book How Children Love to Learn by Elaine Cooper, says, the life and training of these students would also make them aware of the intimacies and relationships in learning that come from being persons, relationships beginning with God, the author of knowledge, and extending to nature, books and living ideas, handicrafts, maps and local geography, the sweep of history with its people, places and events, the beauty of art, music, poetry, the very real day-to-day existence of people in community. So what we learn is not just for the sake of knowledge, but also a call for us as learners to understand the world in which we are to relate and which we are to relate to one another. So this turns me to my final point, dignity, the need for dignity. So we had the need for delight, the need for coherence, and now the need for dignity. Now, this is where you would think secular education has been most successful. It is student-centered, based upon positive psychology through the impact of Carl Rogers and his theories of education. Yet what we've seen is the opposite effect, that nurturing the emotional welfare of students has actually harmed them, has hurt them. Jonathan Haidt, who I mentioned earlier, a psychologist and professor at NYU, has called this safetyism. Safetyism refers to a culture or belief system in which safety has become a sacred value, which means that people become unwilling to make trade-offs demanded by other practical and moral concerns. Basically, what he's saying there is that the highest, most demanding value over free speech, over tolerance, is safety. And safety is defined as emotional safety, that I am not triggered. It's not by what you intend, but how I'm impacted. So how can we tend to students in order not to cause them emotional harm? This is what Haidt is referring to as safetyism. Now, Haidt says the problem with this is that it debilitates their students to gain resilience. Resilience for a trying and difficult world. That the world that they leave, you know, when they leave the university, they're going to not get an easier world. but a more difficult and complicated world. Now, Hyde is influenced by his practice as a CBT, so as a cognitive behavioral therapist. And in cognitive behavioral therapy, it encourages clients to readdress their trauma and to try to reframe it, with new thinking or new ideas. So cognitive behavior, fixing the cognition in order to behave well with past harm, past triggers. But Hyde fears that trying to keep students from emotional harm or triggers actually worsens their condition. That he says that avoiding triggers is not a solution, but a symptom of trauma. Avoiding triggers is not a solution, but the symptom of trauma. So he says about safetyism in schools, when children are raised in a culture of safetyism, it may set up a feedback loop. Kids become more fragile and less resilient, which signals adults to give more protection, which then makes them even more fragile and less resilient. It's this vicious cycle of making people more and more coddled or more more fragile. Just a few years ago, during Trump's presidency, which was interesting, 4 years for America. I don't know if you heard about it. But we had a student came to LaBrie, and we were having a discussion. And someone mentioned the name Trump. Just mentioned the name, not policy, not in favor, not against, just named Trump. And one of the students started shaking and started like having a migraine, and she left to go throw up. She had a physiological response to the name of Trump. Now, there were real traumas in her life that had brought about that. But but how she had faced her trauma, past traumas, had actually made her less resilient, more fragile, in the face of difficult discussions. And in fact, what we have is that we see this on university campuses in what is called cancel culture, which I know has all its connotations. But one example Hyde brings up is that Middlebury College, Charles Murray, or Murray, I can't ever remember how to say his name, but he had made statements in 1994 about IQ and the differences in IQ. But he was coming to talk about a different book about the economic plight of poor people in America. And the students at Middlebury were so angry that they tried to attack him, and they were able to successfully attack this woman who was just representing him, even though she didn't necessarily agree with him. So what you have is not only this rise of safetyism causing people to be more fragile and less resilient, but it's called students to become more proactive. When the teachers are not protecting them, the administration is not protecting them, they need to rise up. And when verbal statements or potential verbal statements can be considered violent, then physical violence can result as something seen as just. And so that all harkens back to feelings over fact. That what is true is not us trying to discern what's out there in relation to ourselves, but how I perceive it is the truth. Well, Jonathan Hyde says, well, I think that there's a way forward. He thinks that we need the possibility of rigorous university education. And so he and others are on this board of the University of Austin in Texas. It's not a school yet, but they're wanting it to be a school. I believe it was mentioned even last year. But you can see where it says, I don't have a quote. I'm going to go over here. You can't read it, can you? Let me pick up my computer. Ooh. I'm all attached to technology. Universities devoted to the so all the dark parts are the most important parts. to search out a matter. Okay, universities devoted to the unfettered pursuit of truth are the cornerstone of a free and flourishing democratic society. For universities to serve their purpose, they must be fully committed to freedom of inquiry, freedom of conscience, and civil discourse. In order to maintain these principles, UATX will be fiercely independent financially, intellectually, and politically. So he, like Jordan Peterson and others, are really advocating for free speech, freedom of conscience, freedom of thought. Is this what Christians should want? Is it sufficient for what ails education today? I would say it's an improvement, but when it still fails to have coherence and the fuller vision of what it means to be human, I think it does not go far enough. It is an improvement, but not far enough. So Charlotte Mason, I think, goes further, and she's basically asking, how do we produce the atmosphere that does more than just exercise the mind and actually nurtures the heart of the learner? I think Haidt and the others are advocating for the freedom of mind, the rigor of the mind, and even the freedom and dignity of being able to speak their own minds. But it's more than just that. What kind of atmosphere? Education is atmosphere, Charlotte Mason would say. C.S. Lewis says, we need to train students to learn to love what is noble, to have them react in vileness when they see something wicked. Not just to recognize the moral law, but to love it, that it might taste like honey to our tongues. And ultimately, a person does need to be transformed by Jesus to understand these things. Yet, in considering a theory of education based upon a biblical worldview, we must consider the ways in which atmosphere affects this biblical view of education. So whether someone is in a homeschool setting or a public one or private, how might we affirm the learner as made in the image of God? And I love Susan Schaefer McCauley says this beautiful line. She says, well, take a small child on your knee, respect him. Do not see him as something to prune, form, or mold. This is an individual who thinks, acts, and feels. He's a separate human being whose strength lies in who he is, not in who he will become. So we desire something for them to become, but we need to start with the delight of the learner. And I would say that many school teachers do not have the delight of their learners. The best teachers are the ones who love their students. And so each person is to have this independence, not this autonomy, but because they're made in God's image, whether they love him or not, whether they know him or not. And so Susan Schaefer McCauley is wanting to respect that each person deserves freedom to act, think, and feel on their own, that we need to treat them as having dignity prior to anything else. But dignity is not simply just for one's own action. It is because we're made in the Creator's image, there's also a moral responsibility to understand and to love what the Creator has made. So it's not just that we bear His image and therefore have dignity, which is true, but we bear that image in order that we might love what He loves, be responsible for what He has commissioned us to tend. So what might this look like in educational practices? Well, Elaine Cooper draws out a few comments. I don't know if she got them from Charlotte Mason or not. But says that there shouldn't be a heavy moralism or guilt. Learning doesn't become a delight then. It just becomes a burden, a performance to make the parents happy or the teacher happy and to get them off their backs. One should also avoid a push for competition or comparison. I'm guilty of this. Mm-hmm. I try to tell my son I want him just to want it more, you know, and probably it's my own ego getting in the way. to be honest. But we need to not just try to compete or compare, but we need to see that the learning activity is a communal event, not just an individual event. And in fact, the teacher is really good when they become a co-learner, a co-lover of knowledge. She also belittled the overemphasis on tests and evaluations. Now, competency is important, but not to the point where it diminishes curiosity or creativity of thinking outside the lines. We need to always keep in mind, what is the goal of learning? And so Charlotte Mason, I can't remember, I'm going to botch this quote, but it's something like this, that I don't care what a child knows, I just want to know how much they want to know. Do they have a love for learning? Not just are they smart, but do they have a love for learning? And if your child graduates from school and university and still loves learning, then that's success, because they will continue to learn and mature through that learning. And then also an encouragement of beauty and play as a part of the learning process. So often we're just filling in blanks or ticking off boxes. But recess is where children learn to play. My daughter probably learns just as much from any study as she does from taking care of our chickens. We have 70 chickens. And she names them all, and she can identify them all. In fact, it's redeeming my love for chickens. She has such delight in particularities. No, this sapphire, this isn't Blondie, you know. And don't you see the comb, you know? I'm like, no, I didn't notice that they were different at all. I only know who Crooked is. Crooked is the one that has a crooked beak. She's easy to find. just to try to move to the end, is just also the encouragement of living books to encourage the children or the learners or even ourselves as learners to become familiar with living books. Not just books that are exciting, but books that cause us to reflect. My children love listening to audiobooks, and I like listening to audiobooks. We watch movies, especially when we're super tired, but sometimes it's just really nice just to listen to an audiobook with a talented reader, and you're just, and we went through Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry, and it just really helped us to understand what it was like to be African American in the deep south of Mississippi in the 20s. And that my daughter was thinking how thankful she was for the life that she had. And she was able to reflect and even have tears of joy or sorrow for what was happening to these people. That she was becoming empathetic. These are living books. It's teaching them how to love. And it's not just literature. It can also be nature. Comstock's The Nature Handbook, The Handbook of Nature Study. Have you heard this book? Mm-hmm. Comstock's Handbook of Nature Study was written in 1911, but it's gorgeous and it's beautiful. And it's not kind of like any kind of textbook. It's a book describing the beauty of the world and encouraging people and children to go out into it. So let me conclude. Oh, yeah, that's just people being out in the world. Okay. So education is in a crisis. Young people are being encouraged to interpret the value of the world through the lens of their own feelings or experiences against a brutal, pitiless nature. And so this should give us cause for compassion and longing to help people in this existential crisis, because they're trying to attempt or discover meaning in their lives, to attempt to make sense of the world. Yet the very systems that are attempting to help them are fragmenting them into disconnected fields and reducing their value. This is making them feel more fragile and more confused. And not surprisingly, these same students are becoming more and more animated by the newest ideologies. I've attempted to present three fundamental keys to thinking Christianly or biblically about education as a way forward, to imagine ways of thinking to bring reform to the way we think of education: delight, coherence, dignity. And all of these are held together by love, love creation, love God, love your neighbor and as yourself. These express the biblical framework for how we are to think Christianly about education.